And now, ladies and gentlemen,
check it out.
You've Got to Start Somewhere, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of show business to prove there's no such thing as an overnight success, with your host, Rachel Corbett.
Welcome to the show. Today, I have one of my fave ladies in the business. She is delightful, she is super talented, and she is one of the most down-to-earth people in television. It is the host of Studio 10, Sarah Harris.
Oh, you are a darling. Thank you for saying that stuff.
I'm excited to have you on for a number of reasons. The first is that I think you are spectacular. The second is that the podcast was becoming a bit of a sausage fest.
Yes.
A lot of men on the show. I think you are only the second woman I have had on this program, so it is time that we got some buzzies on the show. I'm glad that yours are here to join me.
I'm pretty flat-chested, but I will do my best.
You and me both. So this show is all about sort of the beginnings of where you started and how you got to where you are, because obviously when you're on the telly all the time, it's something that people don't really talk about anymore, is how you kind of got to that point. And obviously your life from the very beginning was very different to what it is now, growing up with your mum quite young when she had you in Mount Druitt. Was this something that you dreamed of when you were a kid?
Do you know, it probably didn't occur to me that this is something I wanted to do until I was in high school. However, my aunt said to me that she remembers me being an eight-year-old saying that I wanted to be a journalist. Really? I have no recollection of that. But yeah, it certainly hit me later. And it's funny, it's the question of how did you get into TV is something that I am asked so much. Mm. It's one of the first things that people ask at parties or when I meet people, because there's still some sort of, I suppose, romance and mystery behind how you get on the telly. And I think because I've done it for such a long time, I forget that that I do what I do. And you kind of have to stop and say to yourself every now and then, hey, it's pretty cool, actually, what we do.
And it's not an easy question to answer when people go, how did you get into it? And it's like, how long have you got? Like, it was a meandering road of bits and pieces of stuff until here I am.
Yeah, and it's that whole thing of overnight success that took 10 years,
that's
you know. And doing, you know, the crappy jobs and the hard jobs, but that's what makes you a better journalist and an all-rounder and I suppose have a greater respect for all the other parts of the industry as well. Because I started at the bottom, I saw what it was like to be at the bottom looking up at the top and how people treated me at the time. I had some people who were beautiful, people who were not so beautiful. Yeah. And I think I remember going through that and thinking, if I'm ever lucky enough to climb the ladder that high, I want to be nice to the people sort of, you know, who are around me, because it's such a bad look.
Oh, 100%.
When people are wankers.
Yeah, it's, you know, really bad. And when you've been on the receiving end of that, there are some people that take that, let it sink in, and then repeat that behavior. And then there are other people who take that, let it sink in, and go, oh, this feels rubbish and I'm never going to make somebody feel like that. So it's interesting that people go a number of different ways. What were you like as a kid? Were you a performy kind of kid?
Oh, well, I did dance, that's for sure. I was a little bit. I was a performer. I did dance. I was forever putting on little dance shows for my friends and my family, much to their annoyance. I found confidence particularly in performing, but mostly I was a pretty anxious kid, like very very kind of anxious about the world and anxious to be liked.
Yeah.
You know, some people, when they say they have these really carefree childhoods, I didn't really have that. I just remember being very serious and thinking too much about the world all the time. Not carefree because I didn't grow up with much, because it's all I knew. And you know, I just was like any other kid, because that's all I knew. But
what was it that you think made you that way, feeling anxious? And
I don't know, I think it's just an inherent trait in me. It's definitely calmed down as I've become older, but there's almost this sense of this need to be perfect that you kind of have to quieten down as you get older, because it can paralyze you into inaction. But yeah, I just wanted people to like me.
Didn't
as Sally Field would say. But yeah, you kind of, you get comfortable in your skin when you grow up, you know, and yeah. And you care less about what other people think of you.
But then you also realise that the less you care, and it's tricky because sometimes when people say, I don't care what people think about me, I go, oh, you're a horrible person, because it's yes. that I'm going to be awful and I don't care. It's not that that we're talking about. It's that sort of, oh, I am who I am. I'm going to be the best person I can be. I'm going to be nice to people. And if I don't connect with them, if we don't work, that's okay. That not everybody has to like me. But the interesting thing I've certainly found, because I was quite similar as a kid as well, very shy, quite anxious. Even though a lot of people said that I was very out there, I didn't feel out there mm-hmm. inside. Were you the same? I was
exactly the
same.
I
was faking it till I made it.
Exactly the same. Yeah. I totally agree with you on that regard. And when it comes to sort of saying, I don't care, you're exactly right. It's a different way of thinking. So you have to sort of change your mindset. I remember, especially when I first started in TV, I was so desperate to please mm-hmm. that the desperation came across.
Yeah.
So rather than just going, you know what, I'm going to love this story, I'm going to love the process of chasing down a story and coming back and writing a wonderful script and, you know, picking out the best grabs and making this story sing. Instead of caring about that, I was caring about what will people think.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as it was just one day, just something clicked where I went, well, I don't care if they like it or not, I'm excited about this story and this is the way I'm going to approach it. Things started falling into place.
Well, you all of a sudden you have a bit more control over your life, because this is a business that you don't have a great deal of control over. You know, you are at the whim of executives who can like you or not like you. There can be ratings issues. There can be a million different variables that you have zero control over. Mm-hmm. And everything that you put forward into the ether is subjectively consumed. So people will have a million different opinions about what your story was like, what you are like as a presenter, what you seem like as a person, whether they like what you look like or not. All of these things that you can't control. And really the only thing you control is, how can I approach this individual job? Can I do the best job of this? Can I be good at it so I'm sort of proud of myself for doing a good job here? And the rest you just have to kind of leave, right? Because otherwise you drive yourself nuts.
You do. And especially in the game where we offer opinions every day, people can take what you say 30,000 different ways.
Exactly.
The number of times that I've said something that I thought the intent was extremely clear on it, people might have seen an eyebrow raise or heard a tone in my voice that reminded them of something that brings up their own biases and prejudices. So they then make an assumption on what I've said and what I actually mean.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, you know, for a while there, I was trying to keep everyone happy,
yeah.
and I was trying to make myself heard clearly by everyone, but I just became boring and bland and beige. And I just went, well, you actually can't please all of the people all of the time.
No.
You've just, you know, there's this great quote, you know, reputation comes from what people see you doing, and integrity comes from privately how you act. And I suppose a moral code and a moral compass that you decide to follow. And that's what you have to maintain, your integrity, and the rest follows.
You're obviously a really driven person. You know, you don't get to this spot without being quite driven and committed to what you're doing. Was that something that you just were from the very beginning as a little kid? Like, was your mum a real push? Was she somebody who was like, you can be better, you can do anything?
Yeah, well, she, you know, I like to say that, you know, my mum really gave me the first taste of feminism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had me a week after her 18th birthday. I don't think she wanted to change her life, but I think she wanted more for mine.
Mm.
And from the moment that I can remember, she would say, you need to, you know, you can do whatever you want to do, you can be whatever you want to be, you just got to work your bum off and stay humble and, you know, work hard and you will be pushed forward when the time is right. She said, earn your own money, don't be beholden to a man.
Mm-hmm.
And anything you want, you can get if you're willing to work hard for it. I think that's what pushed me and that's what inspired me. And I think part of the reason I've ended up where I am is because it was a bit of luck meets hard work.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate enough to get my foot in the door with some work experience at Channel 7 when I was still in high school. And it's because I worked my ass off when I was there for the week that I was given further opportunities to work for Channel 7.
How did that come about? How did you get
I was in grade 11, they put you on work experience placement. I wanted to be either a director or a lawyer, and I was hoping to be placed at La Boite Theatre in Brisbane. And that's really a path that I see myself going down now, oh my God. Yeah. But yes, so I wanted to go to La Boite Theatre. They put me at Channel 7. I was not overly excited about it, but my teachers at Caboolture High School, which I just cannot say enough about. It was such a wonderful school, and certainly the making of me as a journalist and as a person, I suppose. But as they tend to do with work experience kids, because, you know, TV stations are busy places mm-hmm. and they don't have time to hold work experience kids' hands. So they stuck me in the mail room in the guts of the building at Channel 7 in Brisbane and gave me 1,000 Christmas cards to stuff into envelopes.
Those were always the jobs that you got.
And they must have thought, well, you know, she's sweet for a week.
Yeah.
By the end of the day, I'd finished. Wow. Like, what you got next for me? And I'm like, oh God, we're going to have to give her something else. And then they kept giving me these menial tasks, which I would just bash out. Mm-hmm. And I tried to be keen, but not annoying. And yeah, ended up in the newsroom going out with some journos on the road. And from the moment the very first time I walked into the Channel 7 newsroom, there was this buzz in the air and, you know, journos running around and the chief of staff screaming at someone and phones ringing off the hook. And I was like, I need to be part of this. This is something that I want in on. And yeah, I got bitten really early. I wanted to be a journo. I wanted to be out there reporting, and that's what I put my mind to.
So then was it, okay, I'm going to go study this at university? Was that the plan? You went to uni and studied, and then did that turn into any kind of part-time work or anything there?
So I was basically doing weekend work at Channel 7. I was writing the weather reports and recording the news, which was a huge deal, as well as doing school. I got into international business and journalism at QUT, great university, but then I actually got a regional job. And when I say regional, I got to work on the Gold Coast, which is pretty amazing. I didn't go country, but, you know, I got the feel of a regional newsroom in that I was doing 3 or 4 stories a day. I'd write updates. I'd sit down at the end of the day and do the auto cue for the newsreader, the host of the show, and rinse and repeat, do it all again. And I was doing that Monday to Friday, plus I was doing weekends at Channel 7. So I had to defer uni for a while because I just couldn't keep all balls in the air.
Mm.
You know, I ended up leaving uni when I got a full-time job because it just made sense to learn the trade on the ground.
Absolutely.
Rather than sit in a class and learn all the theory behind it. It annoys me still, though, that I've got these like 4 subjects left to do, and it's never going to get done. And it's just, I wish I did have that piece of paper, because I actually worked really bloody hard at school and I did well, and I just didn't have the time.
The time would have lapsed now. You couldn't go back and finish those 4 subjects, could you? No.
Thanks, Rach.
Wow, way to make you feel bad. I actually went back to uni and did journalism at nights like a couple of years ago.
See, now I sort of go, well, what's there to learn about journalism? Maybe if I went back, I'd do, I don't know, political science.
Yeah.
Or a psychology degree, you know, to deal with all the sociopaths that work in the media.
Yeah, totally. It does help.
Or something that kind of, you know, gives me a niche or, you know, a separate interest, because I look at kids that are going through journalism school these days, and they're debating, you know, the importance of ethics when it comes to news stories and things like that. But it's done in such a vacuum. It's not done in a space where there are newspapers folding because they don't have any revenue to keep reporters in jobs. You know, like we can't exist in this, you know, we're just out for the pursuit of truth, and we're not up against, you know, online news and Facebook and Google News and that type of thing. We need to be smarter about the way we approach journalism and monetize it in a way as well, without completely disregarding our journalism values.
Mm. And a lot of kids will sit in the classroom and sort of say, I would never do this, that and the other thing. It's like, but if you got offered a job that paid you well, you would take it.
Or if a chief of staff is screaming at you and, you know, 2 other channels are pushing the limits on something on the road and trying to lock up talent. And another big thing that kids often do is they say, well, we would never do death knocks. Well, you don't know if you're in that position until you're in that
What's
position.
What's a desk knock?
A death knock.
Oh, a death knock.
That's where it's horrible. It's where you go and knock on the door of a family who's lost a loved one.
Oh, have you had to do that?
I've done a number of them over the years. Some have been really positive. I've been welcomed into the homes of people who've lost, you know, family members, and sat with, you know, mums and dads and had cups of tea and told their stories. Other times, quite rightly so, I've had the door slammed in my face. I've had things thrown at me. It's one of those strange situations where people say, you shouldn't do death knocks. It's an invasion of privacy. We wouldn't do them if people didn't watch them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and your job as a journalist is to ask the question and go. When I was doing them, and they were awful, but to keep them so brief, you knock on the door, you say, look, I'm a journalist. I don't want to be here. I know you probably don't want me here, but I just need to ask, do you want to say anything? Would you like to tell your story? They can either tell you to F off,
yeah,
or they invite you in. And some of them do find it cathartic to pay tribute to a son or a daughter or to share a story about. I remember once in Brisbane, there was an 18-year-old kid who was driving home from work, and he was working shift work and hadn't had sleep for days, and, you know, single car accident, crashed into a tree. And, you know, his dad wanted to talk to me to warn other kids about the dangers of working shift work and not having a rest and working too hard. And the big message that he wanted other kids to know and to take away was it's not worth it. It's not worth putting your life at risk if you're being worked to the bone.
I guess the interesting thing about being a journalist often is that you are very much on the front line of life, of history, of, you know, you're often sent to the floods, the cyclones, those moments that, you know, are flashed all over the news, and, you know, going and knocking on the door of somebody who's just lost a life. You know, it's not sitting at a desk sending emails all day. It's like really gritty, interesting, for want of a better word, work. You know, there's elements of it that are difficult, but it's a pretty big privilege to be the person that gets to go and see those things and talk to those people.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly, you know, I've travelled the world and I've covered some pretty big stories, and there have been moments when I was standing outside Westminster Abbey when, she wasn't the Duchess of Cambridge then, but Kate Middleton, she got out of the car, and, you know, her sister Pippa and that famous derriere, you know, and I sort of had to pinch myself and go, this is such a moment. This moment is going to be played over and over and over again for years and decades and centuries to come. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was so cool to be part of that. I got to travel to Gallipoli, to Anzac Cove, and be there as Australians commemorated Anzac Day, and it was a really emotional moment. And it was funny because you're awake literally for 24 hours because of the time difference, and you're servicing all these different news services, you know, the daytime news, breakfast television, on the phone to radio all day. So you're pretty tired, but you're running on adrenaline. And then the moment itself, when the sun rises and the last post plays, it's so emotional and so overwhelming. I burst into tears.
Yeah.
And you kind of, I don't know, you see it as a not just a journalist who's going, right, I've got to get 5 minutes of copy down, and I need to voice it in the car under a blanket so the sound's okay. And I've got this cross coming up at, you know, 11:30, and I've got to do a quick radio cross as well to that FM station that's calling from Newcastle. All right, is my hair okay? You're also going, I'm just so fortunate to be standing here and to be standing on such sacred ground and you know, witnessing this moment in history. It's pretty cool.
Do you miss being on the road?
Sometimes, yeah, I do. Yeah. I do, because you just live off adrenaline. And, you know, there's a certain competition. It's a friendly competition on the road as well, because you reach out for a scoop against other journos. And look, at the end of the day, you know, when we've all filed, we all would go to the local pub and, you know, have a beer and talk about what went wrong in our day and what went right. But, yeah, I do miss it. When big stories break, I think, oh, God, I wish I was there.
Yeah.
Because that's what you kind of live for, you know, talking to people and telling people's stories. But it was the day-to-day reporting, sort of the petty crime, a stick up at 7-Eleven, you know, with a syringe, where you're just going, this is a bit soul-destroying.
Yeah, totally.
It's sort of, it just got exhausting.
So how did the move from Sydney happen? How long were you working on the Gold Coast?
Well, I did Gold Coast for 6 months and then I got picked up for a 5:30 show at Channel 7. It's my first, I suppose, metropolitan on-air gig with a little show called Local Edition.
Oh.
It was a 5:30 local current affairs show. So think about ACCA, but at 5:30.
Yeah, right.
And it lasted 3 months.
Yeah.
So that was my first taste of being axed. I'd signed a run of show contract. I'd quit uni, you know, for this big glittering TV career. And then 3 months later, I found myself out of a job.
How did you feel when you got the news?
I was pretty devastated because I'd been at Seven for, I suppose, I don't know, almost four years.
Mm.
And even though I was a casual basis, these were my friends and I felt like I'd grown up there in a way. So, yeah, that was really hard. And for 2.5 months, I was out of a job. And, you know, I was looking at perhaps going to be a producer on Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have led my life into an entirely different direction because I would have ended up in, you know, production and behind the scenes.
Why did you decide not to go that way?
Well, I was offered another job, a researching job on the desk behind the scenes at another 5:30 local current affairs show called Extra at Channel 9. Even though it was off air and I was behind the scenes, I'm not adverse to taking a step back and learning how to do things properly. Mm-hmm. I find that I'm more confident if I know how things work.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. It's amazing how many people don't.
I think women.
Yeah.
Like I've got one of my good friends. She was going for a job promotion. And she's like, I just don't feel like I've got the runs on the board yet. And I'm like, do you know what? A bloke would not be saying this.
Yes.
They'd be going, well, let's just see how we go. We're
going
to fake it. Whereas I felt like I needed to, that my scripting needed improving, that I needed a bit more time, you know, chasing, you know, learning how to chase down talent on phones and focus more on rundown construction. Whereas the blokes are like, yeah, just throw it at me. Let's see how we go.
It's that whole Sheryl Sandberg lean in thing where she says the exact same thing. You know, women, we want to be 100% across everything and then feel like, okay, I now feel I am fully qualified to put myself forward for that position. Whereas a bloke will go, I'm not qualified, but I'll give it a crack.
Totally. It's so true.
Yeah.
And it's it kind of annoys me that I've done that over the years that I haven't backed myself. But then sometimes I also go and there's, you know, like there was a, you know, I've done the hard yards.
Mm.
Like I just didn't, you know, sweep into Studio 10 and start hosting a show. I have worked in breakfast television twice. I've worked in the Brisbane newsroom. I've worked on the Gold Coast. I've done my time in regions. I've done everything from recording the news on videotapes to making coffee to riding the bloody weather to doing auto cue. You know, I kind of feel like now, you know what, like I do deserve, you know, to kind of be sitting here. And that, I think that helps your confidence. I think as well, sometimes we do get attacked by kind of that imposter syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of helps alleviate it a little bit, knowing that I've got those runs.
Of course. And I think while it's, you know, a lot of people would argue, oh, well, as women, we should just jump on in, taking the gender out of it, I feel like that sort of, at least for me as a person, you seem like the same kind of person. I need to know where the furniture is and how things work to feel like I have a place in the room.
That's true. That's
and
good.
So while even though, okay, my career might have gone, you know, a lot quicker if I had have just thrown myself in, I as a person don't function that way. I don't want to feel like people are looking at me going, she doesn't know what she's doing, she's faking it. I want to sit in a room and go, I am supposed to be here. And the only way you can do that is if it takes you a really long time of shoveling shit to get to the point where you go, okay, I've done enough of the hard yards, I now deserve a place here.
Yeah, you've taken the long way round.
Mm.
You know, you've hit the nail on the head. It's exactly how I feel. And I wonder if I had been more bolshy and had pushed myself forward, whether I would be where I am, you know? And, you know, it's that whole delayed gratification as well. If you're going to do something, do it right. But it's really interesting that you say that you've got to know how things work because you don't want other people thinking she's an imposter, you know, she's shit at a job, she shouldn't be here. are they thinking that, or is that what we're
probably
thinking?
Probably not. That's my issue. Yeah, exactly. 100%.
Yeah, and I'm the same. Yeah. Like, I don't think people really are listening that much. And everyone's so self-absorbed.
Yeah, and I also think everybody is in the same boat. I think everybody else is in the room going, how did I get here? I hope nobody realises that I didn't, you know, I snuck in the back way. I think everybody, we are all trying to do this kind of act of, yep, we got life down pat, and most of us haven't. And so it's completely my issue, 100%. It's me thinking that other people, but I also know that that feeling of anxiety in me, I don't like it. And the only way I can get rid of it is if I put in the time to feel like I have earned it, and then I won't feel that anxiety anymore.
And I think it's really important as well to have women like you and I who are down the road a bit. You know, we're certainly not at the top of our top of our game, but you know, we've got a bit of experience under our belt. I think it's important that we do share our experience of feeling a bit insecure and being imposters, because I think there are, you know, probably women who are 10 years behind us going, oh, they seem like they've got it all together, when we don't. We're just making it up as well. And I think I had this, you know, great conversation with this fabulous doctor I know, and she said, you know, as women, we want to break the glass ceiling, turn around, reach back, and help other women up as well, you know? And I think what tends to happen, particularly in the media, is that we are kind of taught to feel that there's only one or two jobs and that we should all be competing with each other. But, you know, the more women there are on TV, the better it is for everyone. A rising tide lifts all boats. Yes. You know, there is room for everyone. There really is. And I think supporting women and mentoring younger women is something that we should really be doing as well to help them come through.
Of course, because it's more, again, it's your own issue if you don't want to help other people up. It's your own insecurity about your own ability. And the truth is, there are a million different reasons why you might not get a job and another woman might get it. It's not a personal slight on you. And there is enough pie for everybody to eat. You know, and at the end of the day, if you get to the top of the tree and you've got no one to turn around and everybody thinks you're an a-hole because you've been horrible to everybody.
It's not fun.
It's not fun.
Yeah.
You know, you just...
Well, they say already that, you know, success is lonely. It's lonely at the top.
Yeah, yeah.
Finding that fine line and that balance between, you know, loving what you do, being good at what you do, and not being a total asshole.
Exactly. It doesn't serve any purpose because the business is like tiny, tiny, tiny. Yeah. And people change all the time. The number of times that I've come across people now that, you know, are above me or below me or side to me that I worked with 15 years ago that were like work experience kids that are now in a boss position. Like, everybody moves within this business, and you just never know who you're going to work with again. So why would you want to walk into a room and sit down and go, oh God, you're that person that I was really horrible to. Oh no. And now I'm asking you for a job, you
know?
At the end of it, you know, obviously it makes you feel much better about what you're doing if you've been a decent bloody person during the whole process.
Yeah.
So when you moved to Sydney, did you have a job that you moved down here for?
Oh, yes, I didn't
for?
Answer that question.
Please. I am all about the tangent. No.
Wow, it was a big tangent.
Let
oh my
us,
God, I forgot about that
go
question.
Off piece.
Yeah, so I had taken, again, the long way around. I was working at Channel 9 as a researcher on that 5:30 local show, Extra, Brisbane Extra. From there, within a couple of months, I was given an on-air role. I was there for 3 years, and then I got picked up by the Today Show. So I was the Brisbane reporter for the Today Show. Lasted about a year and a half on that, and there were some big changes, big cuts to the Today Show. I went back to the newsroom, which I really wanted to do. I didn't feel like I had my news chops, that I hadn't had time, you know, doing court stories or the police round or that type of thing. So I spent 3 years doing that and really honing my skills as a journo and as a chaser. I was good at getting people across the line to talk and that type of thing. And then I was offered the job at Today Show a second time, and it included a move to Sydney. So I was really funny about moving to Sydney at the start. Like,
why?
I never thought I wanted to come here. Yeah, I was born in, you know, in Western Sydney, in Penrith, grew up in Mount Druitt, moved to Queensland when I was seven. But I love Brisbane so much.
Yeah,
and right. I don't know, I just kind of felt like, oh, I was just too small fry for a big city.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I was this little country mouse moving to the big smoke. And
did you find it hard?
I did. I made the worst decision by moving into a one-bedroom apartment on my own, working crazy hours. I didn't know anyone. I was so desperately lonely.
God, welcome to Hermitsville.
So stupid. Yeah. And I was sort of living in this weird part of town. So I just, I was super lonely. I'd wondered if I'd made the right decision. The hours were crazy. And, you know, I was sort of up at 3 and then I'd AM to do live crosses, and then I'd go and, you know, shoot stories and things, and, you know, be getting home at 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night. Like, they were insane hours. And then there was another big shift at the Today Show, and then I moved to news, which, again, like the Nine newsroom in Sydney was something that I was just blown away to be considered for. And again, that gave me, threw a whole new bunch of challenges at me and a whole new bunch of opportunities, which was fabulous, which was great.
Was that the sort of first job that you went, ooh, I could be going somewhere big here?
Yeah, and being sent on international stories and things like that, that really, it's weird because it was exciting but also terrifying, you know, and I just, it was a really stressful time because you're so desperate to prove yourself and to impress and, you know, to, you're playing with the big boys, you know, and, you know, if you miss a scoop or miss a shot, it's not like, oh, well, try again tomorrow. It's, why'd you miss that?
Yeah.
Do you know the other, how many other women are, or how many other people are in line for your job? You know? And it was that kind of operating from fear all the time.
Yes.
You know, which is, I understand it, and like newsrooms do it all the time. Like they want,
everybody does it, I think, in the business, but I still
they
haven't
want you to be hungry.
Yeah. But I haven't quite processed in my mind whether I think that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting management style, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes it can go the other way. I think if you have your employees constantly working from a position of fear and insecurity, yes, it can make you hungry for something and, you know, make a newsroom kind of like trying to survive the Hunger Games. But that's also a problem, that your newsroom is so divided and, you know, you compete with each other so much that you're not a unit.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not a team as much. But it's finding that balance between keeping everyone competitive but also keeping you as a team and as a family, because you spend so much of your time there. You want to like the people that you work next to.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you had any sort of mentors or people through the years that have helped you through, or it's been a pretty kind of me, myself, and I experience?
No, I've had some great mentors, and up until like the last 5 years, it's mostly been blokes.
Yeah, me too.
and it's funny because, I mean, Jessica Rowe is one of my biggest mentors now.
She is such a delightful human.
It's insane.
It's disgraceful.
I know. She's so nice.
She is so sweet.
But you know what? She's not this sickly sweet pushover. She's strong and she's smart and she's fierce and she's fiery when she needs to be. The shit that she went through is appalling. But I tell you what, it's made her what she is today.
Yeah.
And she is not pushed over by anyone. She gives me such wonderful advice about all manner of things, you know, when it comes to juggling kids and work, just basic things as well. Like, she can see me getting, you know, if I get a bit stressed out or anxious over something, or if I tend to overthink things, like something in a script, I'll overthink it, and she'll go, just let it go. It's fine. It's cool, you know. But she's you know, 10 years down from me as well. So I hope that I'm saying that sort of thing to a girl sort of behind me in the future as well. So she's just great, and she's always there on the phone, ready to talk me off the ledge if needed. But until then, though, mostly blokes, and I don't know why that is. Why do you think it is?
Because that's who I worked with mostly.
Yeah.
You know, and while some blokes were delightful, a lot were not delightful to me. But I often found with women exactly what you were saying earlier. I guess I was naive in a lot of ways. I came into the media expecting that we were always all going to be great friends. friends, and I'm very competitive with myself, but I've never been competitive with anybody else. I'm just not. I just don't care if I win or lose with somebody. It doesn't bother me. But did I do better than the last time I did? That's what I give a shit about. And so I felt a bit burned by a lot of women that I met early on, particularly in radio, because I felt like there was a big lot of competition there and that they saw me as a threat. And I always thought, well, I'm not here to try and take your job. Like, I don't want to. So I sort of got to the stage where I'd met more women than like that than not. In the later part of my career, maybe it's because I'm less insecure as a person now than I was back then. Maybe I was attracting the wrong kind of people. I don't know. I probably had something to do with it. Maybe it's just because I've been in the business longer. I've found a lot more women like you where I go, oh, you know, you think the same as me. You think there's a pie for everybody, you know, and you want to be supportive too. So maybe it's just a time thing that it takes a little longer to find the people that you connect with and that share those values. But eventually, the more time you spend in the business, the more you come across those people.
And I think you're right, though. I think there are certainly more women in positions of power that are there to offer a hand and to lend a hand and to give you advice. And because I think even when I started back in 1996, I reckon there were about three women in the newsroom. And then four if you include the secretary, you know. And now, I mean, I sit on pretty much an all-female panel, minus Joe Hildebrand, who also is a wonderful mentor to me. You know, he's such a dude.
He's
like the, you know, the big brother I never had. And, you know, he gives me all sorts of advice about all manner of things. The bloke is just off the charts intelligent and crazy. But, yeah, so it's, I don't know, I think it's changed. And I think maybe the media, it's like there are more jobs, so maybe people are less insecure about, like, you think back to 20 years ago, there was like 6 o'clock news, that's it. There wasn't really a daytime news. There weren't too many kind of options. So there's more channels now, more opportunities to have part of that pie, as you keep saying.
It must be nice being on the show that you're on now, where, you know, I've done the show a couple of times, and one of the great things is that everybody gets along, and you guys are so generous as a guest when you come on. Sometimes you can go into shows and you're like, oh, this is awkward and I feel a bit weird, like I'm being slotted in and nobody really knows. But you guys are so open and generous, and I think a huge amount of that has to do with you individually as people, but also your chemistry as a team. You all seem to get along really, really well. And I guess when you're kind of assessing your career and thinking about how you feel about what you're doing, that's a big part of it too, because you're not sitting on a panel where everybody's aggressively Hunger Games-ing each other. You're sitting on a panel with people who are all professionals in their own right, or all confident in their own ability, and can actually have a mature, open, emotionally intelligent relationship with each other while hosting a show at the same time. So it's nice.
It is nice. And, you know, we do genuinely get along. We are a very close team. It's not to say that, I mean, we tackle 15, 16 topics a day where we're arguing about anything from politics to religion. They say never talk about that sort of stuff. And we, you know, we're debating it tooth and nail. But, you know, that sometimes, you know, some of the arguments can get quite passionate because we're all journos. We all have very strong opinions. But I think we've just learned to park it and know what it is. See it for what it is. It's a conversation that we've had on television. It's not an attack on either of us or any of us as people. And play the ball, not the man, I suppose. We all kind of, that's sort of a motto that I certainly live by anyway.
You need to have conflict, right? If you're all in furious agreement,
you know,
be like, yawn.
And it's so funny as well, because you don't know which way some people are going to go. Sorry about that. You don't know which way some people are going to go from day to day, and how people, you know, are going to react. Like, there are some things that I think Jess is going to answer it this way, and she'll completely surprise me and argue passionately about something, you know, in a totally different way or regard. She'll come at it from such an interesting, unusual angle. And I must say, like, sometimes I walk away from some of our conversations going, I actually feel like I got smarter from that.
Yeah, which is great.
And that's a good space to be in,
yeah,
right? Where
absolutely.
You learn something and you have, you know, you have your views challenged. And I'm not one of those people that's completely dogmatic and thinks that it's my way, you know, it's my opinion. Mm. I want to be challenged.
Yeah.
You know, make me think.
Yeah.
You know, make me change my point of view. Argue it.
That's why I could never do AM radio, because I am a bendable reed. If you give me a logical explanation, then I will completely do a 180 on my point and go, that is an excellent point. I'm coming over to your side now.
And don't you find that so hard as well about writing opinion columns?
Yes.
Because you can see both sides so clearly and you just go, oh God, I can't get angry and can't get...
Yeah, I can't get irate.
Ranty about one side.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very difficult because everybody wants that sort of staunch opinion. And I'm like, yeah, I'll have a staunch opinion on certain things, like if people are assholes to other people, that kind of sort of realm of behaviour I get very aggressively angry about. But, you know, there's certain things I understand everybody is different and people have different opinions, and I can appreciate that that person over there thinks that way, and that, you know, and nobody has it right. Mm. You know, nobody has it 100% right all the time.
But you want to be exposed to good ideas, and I think the whole idea that people just want to watch people be perpetually angry at each other is just so off the mark.
Yeah.
It's boring and it's predictable and makes me frustrated when I see just people constantly yelling at each other. It's like, oh God, turn it off.
But
like,
it's also
get anywhere.
It's also why shows like MasterChef do so well, because it's like people pumping up other people's tires, people celebrating like the everyday man who's got really good skills. And like, I bawled my eyes out at the first episode of this season, because it's just nice people who are coming on and going, oh, this is a little thing I cooked and it's like better than you can get in any restaurant, and all of the chefs are like, oh, you know, Gary and George and Matt are like high-fiving each other, and you're just like, this is nice. People like to watch nice people giving each other high fives.
Feel good telly.
Yeah, it's just sort of feel good TV. You were saying that a couple of the things that you had been to, like Gallipoli and the wedding of the Duke and Duchess, were big moments for you. But obviously in every career there are just those ridiculous nothing stories that you cover. And I bring this up because I want to know what one of the worst was, and I also want to know if it might be the story that we first met on, which was when you came to Triple M and we did a which spray tan is
testing
best.
Fake tans. That was a good one. Oh, no, I can do better.
Oh, can't you,
oh, I
please?
Can do better. Yeah, yeah, yeah. An actual story that I've done that I can't believe I presented with a straight face. How to get buried on a budget. How to get buried on a budget.
What yeah. was...
So we looked at all different types of coffins, and the story came up because someone had said, I want to be buried in a cardboard box. And after a few phone calls, we discovered that in Queensland, you can't legally be buried in a cardboard box.
Oh,
you
right.
can only be buried in a balsa wood box.
Okay.
Which led us to think, well, let's look at all the different ways you can get buried. Yeah. So, I've done some crazy stories in the past, but I think they're the ones that challenge you as a writer.
Oh, yeah.
And they challenge the way you – the production that you use, the shots that you use, the way you kind of tell the story visually, your scripting. Yeah, I always found those quirky stories – kind of fun to do. And we had this great office where I had three of my best friends working in the same office. Mm. We would work our guts out all week and then go to the pub all weekend. We just it was the best life. And we would all compete with each other for the best pieces to camera, the best opening
cool.
line. Like, we'd use great music. Like, we all egged each other on to make the best TV. Yeah, it was a pretty fun 3 years at Extra, that's for sure.
What a pity when you did that How to Be Buried story that the old coffin kiosk at Costco hadn't been opened
yet.
Oh,
I know. Costco wasn't even thought of back then. I tell you what, though, I did draw the line because there was a suggestion that I should do a piece of camera coming out of a surprise out of a coffin.
No.
Yeah, but that's probably my most memorable.
It's important that we all have boundaries. It's like, you know what? No, I'm probably not going to start this in a coffin. Do you remember what the call up was like when you got the job here at Studio 10?
Yeah,
do you remember?
I do.
Were you like doing backflips? Were you excited?
Yeah. Well,
did it come about?
Well, it was at a really funny time where I kind of hit this weird crisis of conscience. I was 33 and I wanted to have a family, and I didn't think that working 12, 16 hours a day on the road was conducive to that. Mm-hmm. So I started thinking, do I need to change jobs? Do I need something that's where I can have a bit more life balance? I loved my job so much at Channel 9, but my job was my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't have much time for anything else. So I started looking around and I was on Seek. And looking at PR jobs.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Maybe I'll have some balance if I'm, you know, in PR. And then just out of the blue, Rob McKnight, who's the executive producer, he used to run the promos department at Channel 9, and he said, look, I'd love to screen test you for this little morning show that we're getting up, and I think you'd be a great host. And, you know, I was like, oh, my God, on a panel with Ida Buttrose and Joe Hildebrand, there's no way.
Yeah.
You know, a media icon and Joe. And he's like, just come in and screen test. Just do it anyway. So I did, and it just felt good.
Mm.
And you know when you do something and you kind of know that you nailed it?
Yeah.
I just went, you know, I felt really good about it. And then I got offered the job, and it was a really big decision, you know. Do I leave, you know, Channel 9, where I've been for 12 years, they've given me these amazing opportunities? Do I, you know, hang around and hope that perhaps a presenting job comes up?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I take a risk? And I went, you know what, like, I'm going to take a risk. I'm a big believer in the fact that fortune favours the brave.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, I wanted to get in on Channel 10 that was sort of, it was going up again, you know, mm-hmm. and I wanted to get in before it hit the peak. And I don't know, I liked the irreverence of 10. I think when, you know, you're not number one and there's not a number one crown at stake, you're in a position to take more chances mm-hmm. and be yourself, you know, and I liked that. I liked that idea that I could be myself, find out what works. And I remember thinking to myself, if this doesn't work, I'm done.
Yeah.
I've done my time in telly now. But God, it was such perfect timing for me. And it has opened, you know, my life up to so many wonderful things. It meant that, you know, I've been able to have a baby, a beautiful little boy. I'm in this job that I just adore so much, and was my baby for a long time before Paul came along.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just, it just feels like the perfect balance, the perfect blend. And then I start thinking, it's such, so perfect. It can't last forever.
Oh, you a doomsdayer too, yeah.
Oh, God.
What's going to go wrong?
And then you're like, oh, God. Because it's such a gift,
yeah.
you know, to have this. And you know that it's the nature of the media. Not everything lasts forever, although I'd like it to.
But if you've struggled too and you've worked really hard and you haven't had those opportunities, you know, you haven't been given things on a platter. So there is that sense that, you know, you're not used to being the person who has the perfect job, the perfect life, you know, not obviously everything's not perfect, but that sense of
what's going to go wrong.
Yeah, you can't help it because it's sort of, it's not something you're used to. So I don't think you can help but feel that way. But I think it's such an important thing to feel because that's what keeps you trying.
Mm.
And that's what makes you feel like, okay, I'm going to give this my all so that you don't turn around at the end of 5, 10, 15 years, whatever. If the show was to ever stop, you won't turn around and go, oh, God, I should have put in more effort.
Yes. And you can't become complacent. I think that's definitely a very key point. But also, so you don't want to live from a place of constant fear and constant insecurity. What I've tried to channel some of that into is being grateful and knowing that it all could go belly up tomorrow. So enjoy it now. Be present, be in the moment. But yeah, I think the moment you get complacent and the moment you get cocky, the moment you got to get out of the game.
Definitely. How has having a family changed things for you?
Do you know what? I think it's given me an extra kind of extra depth as someone who sits on a panel and commentates and comments on things.
I think it's a real asset in this business.
Yeah,
I know that I've seen interviews where you've said previously that there was a part of you that was like, oh goodness, having children, like, it does that mean they're going to replace me? Is that, you know, there,
well,
is that fear?
Well, you know, you have a look at, you know. Just recently, Talitha Cummins, one of my dearest friends, you know, she's had to go to court and fight Channel 7 after they sacked her on maternity leave. Mm. Jessica Rose, written about it in her book, being sacked from Channel 9. So I can't believe this shit still happens.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'd be lying if I, you know, said that I wasn't worried about it and that it's all cool. I've got to say though, Channel 10 has been pretty brilliant when it comes to me having babies. I was heavily pregnant doing Shark Tank. Pregnant. I mean 37 weeks pregnant. Wow. They had to shoot me from different angles because I was so huge. But I actually thought that was so cool that they, you know, because I actually said, do you still want to use me? I am going to be very heavily pregnant. And our program director, Bev McGarvey, who was going through his second pregnancy at the time, she's like, yeah, absolutely. You know, people get pregnant, people have babies. And I thought that was the coolest thing and the best approach and really enlightened to say that to someone, you know, like I was 95 kilos in heels, you know, they could have gone, look, you know, you're just not the right look, but it didn't matter. Yeah, I thought that was cool.
And there's plenty of women watching who are pregnant or otherwise or who are like, oh, look at that, a woman just like me on
That's
the telly.
Right. And like even, you know, even with Studio 10 being pregnant, you know, there was no hiding the bump. I got shown from every single angle. And you know what? Most of the feedback was pretty positive. And I think people have become more used to pregnant bellies on television. Mm-hmm. Nikki Buckley, we had her on the show. She used to be, of course, on Wheel of Fortune.
Yes.
And she said that when she was pregnant and wore a formal gown that showed her belly in all of its gorgeous beauty and glory, she got hate mail.
Wow.
Saying, you know, it was disgusting. It was akin to being naked on TV. Oh, and you just think, how much have we changed? But how much still remains the same?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best and the worst thing about the business?
Oh, the best thing about the business is the adrenaline, the buzz. You know, when you come off air or you nail an interview and it's almost like everything in the universe is working in perfect harmony and it just feels right. That's the best thing, the buzz, the adrenaline. The worst thing would be the insecurity, I think.
Yeah.
Just the, you know, being insecure about losing your job and how you look. But I suppose every job does have an element of that where you think it might all end tomorrow. So that would be the best and worst.
Do you still get nervous?
You know, I do sometimes if we've got a great guest on. There's always a butterfly.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, Richard Wilkins, I asked him this same question when I first started out on the Today Show. And he said, yeah, I get nervous all the time. And the moment you don't get nervous is when it's time to give the game away because you're not having fun anymore and you don't care about what you're putting to air.
Yeah.
But particularly if it's a big interview, you know, or a guest that I really admire, like Andrew Denton was on our panel.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, like for 2.5 hours, I just felt sick. I was like, oh, my God, I shouldn't be sitting here. You should be sitting here, you know?
Yeah, it's also hard when you sit down next to people who you just desperately want them to walk away and go, they were delightful, you know? Yeah. You're like, I've got to get that balance between not trying too hard but, like, being impressive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I think, you know, a degree of nerves is always good because it keeps you on your game.
You know, definitely.
When you're operating from that place of slight fear and definitely adrenaline, you know, that's why live TV is always, it's live and it's dangerous and it's got this raw energy about it.
So, yeah, and it's a real skill to keep it on track when the wheels fall off, which you are exceptionally good at, I have to say.
Oh, thanks.
Right, we're down to the final five questions now. Ooh, we got
like
through
it.
Like
speed round?
Yeah, it is. We're into the speed round. I wish I had an impressive like choo-choo-choo intro or something to put in, but those little crappy sound effects we'll have to do. The first question, your biggest regret?
Ooh. My biggest regret is not just relaxing earlier, you know. It probably wasn't until like I was 30 that things started to really click into place. Like for a good 10 years from in my 20s, I was so bloody hard on myself. I just wished I would have relaxed a bit, gone with the flow a bit more. You know, people would always go, you just got to relax, you just got to relax. It's like, you're making me stressed by saying I've got to relax. I wish I was a bit more relaxed in my 20s and had cooled my jets a little bit in a way, because the moment you do relax into it, things just start happening for you.
But maybe you needed that non-relaxed time to get to your relaxed time.
Well, this is it, isn't it? It's like a sliding doors moment.
Yeah, you just never know.
You don't know which way the universe would have led you.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Your dream gig. I think it might be this one.
Yeah, definitely. I Honestly, it is it's the perfect balance. I get to laugh. I get to have passionate arguments with people. We get to interview incredible people. It's a pretty sweet gig. Mm. It's a pretty sweet gig. And if it can last for another 10 years at least, I'll be very happy.
Is there a big idea that you've had that has yet to get up or something that you've still got on the to-do list?
No, I don't really have no.
Are you one of those people that wants to write a book one day?
Oh, like that sort of thing. I thought you meant about TV.
No, I mean, could be TV, could be anything. No, you could want to start a band.
Do you know, it's funny. I would love to write a book.
Fiction, non-fiction?
Probably non-fiction.
Oh, do you have the imagination for it? I would love to too, but I don't have the imagination for a fake story.
No, non-fiction.
Oh, non-fiction.
Oh, God. I'm thinking, oh, shit, I've got it wrong.
No, I've got it wrong. No. You've said words and I've heard what I wanted to hear.
I've got an idea for a kind of a memoir which is non-fiction but with fictional parts to it. So I don't know. I took some time off about 8 weeks when I was over at Nine, and I went to Paris and I just sat in a cafe and just brainstormed and drank coffee, and I haven't gone anywhere with it yet, but it's sitting there in the back shelf of my brain.
That's
but like
cool.
I don't know. I just sort of think, because I'm the only one on my panel that hasn't written a book. Jess has written a book. Ida's written a book. Joe's written a book. Right. Denise has written a book. And I go, does anyone really want to read a story about me?
Of course they do.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it just seems like such a self-absorbed pursuit.
Yeah.
But it's almost like, you know, wanting to run a marathon. I feel like I've got to tick it off my list at some point, but I feel like I've still got some stories that I need to live before I put them down on paper.
If you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
I always think about this because, you know, I am such a doomsdayer that I think that I might need to. I don't know. My latest thing is that I'd like to open a Pilates studio.
Oh, which, I love this. Which, I will come to your classes.
Which my husband just thinks is so funny. That or open a bookstore. I love walking past bookstores and smelling books.
They're coming back now.
Oh, I love them.
Yeah, it's like the Polaroid camera, you know. Everybody stopped making Hipster. Polaroid film, and then people were like, oh, I really miss the Polaroid camera. Same with vinyl. It's coming back. Apparently people are getting eye strain from the Kindle and books are coming back.
Oh, but there's something about holding a book, isn't there, and dog-earing the pages.
Yeah. I can't bear reading on a Kindle or anything electronic. I just need to be holding the book.
Yeah.
And I think having something like a little bookshop or something, it's like a bit of a romantic kind of idea, isn't it?
Yeah, that old Pilates studio, which Tom also says, you hardly go to Pilates classes as it is. I'm like, yeah, but if I owned one, I'd feel like I had to go.
It would be different. Is that just your tactic to make yourself go to Pilates?
Yeah, pretty much, just buy my own.
Just own the studios. Yeah. So it's a financial decision.
Yeah.
And finally, your advice to people wanting to get into the business.
Go the long way round. Do the hard yards. Don't take anything for granted. Be curious and stay humble.
Good advice. And on that note, you now get to go home. You've been at work all morning. So thank you so much for joining me, Sarah. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, darling.
Thanks for listening to You've Got to Start Somewhere.
Thanks.
To subscribe to the podcast, check out other episodes and keep up to date, head to youvegottostartsomewhere.com.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Sarah Harris. What a delightful human she is. And next week on the show, another delightful human, one of the hosts of The Project, a man who's been making us laugh on our TV screens and on radio and on stage for many years, Mr. Peter Hellyer. We talk about how he got into the business, some of the early gigs he'd rather forget, and of course his time on Rove Live, including the transition from Channel 9 to Channel 10 when Channel 9 cancelled the show originally, and the decision that Rove made during that time that changed Peter's career.
It was just such an amazing experience. And we sort of did the pilot early that year, and then like we did the series later that year, and then they let us go. They wanted to keep Rove. And Rove, to his undying credit, and my career is based on a lot of what happened with Rove, he was offered like $1 million to stay. He's a 23-year-old, but to cast everybody else adrift. And he was fearful of being warehoused, but also he knew, I think he had a good thing, he had a good team, and has said no without the promise of anything. He wasn't walking away going, Channel 10 will pick this up. That was not on the cards. The last thing he wanted to do was be put into a game show that he didn't want to do. And that was the stage where people were paid good money to not do a lot.
Mm.
And Rove had no interest in that.
Mm.
With that said, $1 million at 23. That's incredible.
I hope you'll join me for that episode next week. I'll see you then.